first term of Washington, they voted that the vice president's not allowed to talk in the Senate. Yeah. And that's why there's a president pro tempore of the Senate who's like calls everything to order and stuff like that. And that's still today, 200 to 240 years later. We have powerless vice presidents who can't vote on anything besides when there's a tiebreaker, all because John Adams would just make fun of people.
Welcome or welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep under the surface, examining the policies, people, and wild events that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, your casual history connoisseur. My co-host is Eric Mason, our brilliant loose cannon economist, who brings a wealth of knowledge and the wildest of historical facts to the table. And today is Eric Mason's Christmas, because this whole podcast is just a thinly veiled excuse for him to talk about the Adams family. So why don't you go ahead and lead us off with the professional bit that I'm going to clip and send to potential sponsors.
Happily, Kyle. Yeah, today we're going to be diving into the life and legacy of John Adams, America's second president and founding father with a fiery sense of duty. Born in Quincy, Massachusetts. At the time it was called Braintree, but it's Quincy now. Everybody in Braintree, it's Quincy. He developed a lot of big ideas that we still use today around liberty and justice. By the time he took office at age 61, he already left his mark on history. He was a relentless advocate for independence. He stood shoulder to shoulder with his buddy, sometimes enemy, then back to being buddy, Thomas Jefferson, when they drafted the Declaration of Independence. Adams was very outspoken. He was uncompromising, often controversial, a character who helped build the foundation of the Republic, but didn't always make friends along the way. He's a good, really cantankerous man. In the White House, first president of the White House, he found himself really navigating choppy waters, and he did manage to keep the U.S. out of war with France. And he managed to keep us out of a lot of European affairs. He was infamous for the Alien Sedition Act, a decision meant to secure national stability, but one that sparked fierce debates about freedom, government overreach, and the freedom of press. Through all this, Adams leaned on the love of his life, Abigail, who was far more than just a first lady, sharply politically savvy, and never wanted to back down. Abigail Adams was one of Adams' closest advisors. The letters revealed a partnership built on mutual respect and intelligence, with Abigail's advice shaping some of the most important decisions of Adams' career and some of the most important decisions in U.S. history. Though he only served a single term, losing to Thomas Jefferson in a very bitterly contested election in 1800, he did set the course and set precedent for a very critical point in U.S. history. He set the peaceful transition of power, something that has followed through for luckily a couple hundred years since then. After leaving office, he continued to serve, corresponding, advising, and watching the nation he helped build. When he passed away on July 4th, 1826, exactly 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Adams left a legacy behind. More than a legacy, he left an indelible mark on American history with his commitment to public service, his unwavering principles, and his role shaping the government we know today. So join us as we explore the battles, bold decisions, and complicated legacy of John Adams, the president who couldn't stop making history even when he wasn't in office. I'm going to have so much fun this week.
Stick with us to get the scoop on John Adams' policies, precedents, and the stories they never taught you in history class. Remember to follow The Buck Starts Here, where we impact the drama, decisions, and yes, the bucks of every president's time in office. Okay, one quick question. He passed away on July 4th. Did he actually pass away on July 4th, or is this one of those things where, like when President Kennedy was shot in that car in Dallas, he was pronounced dead at the hospital because nobody wanted to pronounce him dead anywhere else. I think that kind of happened similar Lincoln. So did he actually die on that day, or did he die like the day before and they're like, we'll just hang on for a second.
Put him on the warmer. No, he died that day. It's like very, very well documented. And it'd be very anti-John Adams to not reflect reality for reality's sake.
Right.
And Thomas Jefferson also died on the same day as him. And the funny part is Adams' last words were, "Jefferson lives," but Jefferson had died like 6 hours earlier. Oh. You could actually, if you go visit, so John Adams is the only founding father who, a state still exists. It's my picture behind, it's Kyle's picture behind him. You can go to Quincy today. I drive by it every day when I go to work. You can go to Quincy today and see the house he lived in. You can see the chair John Adams died in. That you could see the letter he wrote, the desk he used to write the letters to John Adams. one of my favorite things to do is if you go in front of City Hall where I work, there's a big promenade and it has a statue of John Adams. On the other end, it has a statue of another very famous Quincy resident, John Hancock. And then in the middle, there's a statue of Abigail Adams. And I was walking up to, there's a great little pizza shop and deli across the street. So I was walking up there to get lunch one day, and there's these, you see people taking pictures there all the time during the summer. And I see this guy standing there with his wife. And I go, "Hey, sir, would you like me to take a picture?" He goes, "Yeah," with the statue of John Adams. And he takes his hand up and he puts it on the statue, has John Adams with a walking cane. He puts his hand on it.
Yeah.
And I said, "Sir, are you doing the tours this week?" And he goes, "Yeah, we are." I go, "That stick, that walking stick that John Adams has in the monument is still sitting in the umbrella like basket at the front of the estate. You can go touch that. It's the only place you can
physically."
Yeah, did you do it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I remember seeing that. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, the whole tour is amazing.
Yeah. And that's because he was the only founding father that died with any money. And we're going to do a whole episode on Abigail Adams. Kyle's been being very, very nice to me and letting me do our special, this president's special episode is going to be on the greatest first lady, Abigail Adams. She invested.
Laura would kill me if we didn't.
She invested in a lot. Like she invested in real estate. She invested. She was one of the first people in the U.S. to invest in municipal bonds.
Yep.
And so she made this like huge estate. And it's funny because he was the only founding father. It's like the only president who became founding father who didn't own slaves. And he ended up being the only one who died with any sort of money. So that's why we're so lucky that to this day, you can still go visit all the Adams estates. You can go visit where they're buried. You can go, we have beautiful parks around this. Like, it's still real. That's the coolest part about what we're going to talk about today, on top of John Adams being the most, probably the most noble person ever to be president.
Well, that's a bold statement.
So I stand by it.
All right. Well, do you want to start backing that up then? Where do you want to, what do you want to start talking about this life?
So how many hours do we have for this? Like 15 to 20?
I mean, honestly, be as long as you want. We're shooting for 45-minute episodes, but, I mean, we can make bonus content.
I just can't wait till this podcast turns into just Eric ranting about John Adams.
Right.
So, start at the beginning. So, John Adams, he was born October 30th, 1735. If you're ever in Quincy, Massachusetts, the day before Halloween, come on down. We lay a wreath on his grave. He's buried in the President's Church, which is right across City Hall. So we do a big ceremony every year. It's been going on for like decades and decades. Now, there's a controversy here. So if you ask somebody, if you ask a story where John Adams was born, they're going to say Braintree, Massachusetts, and they are incorrect. They are just wrong, and you can tell them that they're wrong, and they should feel bad about themselves.
Is that why you modified my script on the fly?
Not on the fly. I was just fact-checking it. So the Adams estates are they're in Quincy, Massachusetts, actually in the middle of the city. So
yeah.
Quincy was founded, it's funny, is that Quincy was first settled in 1625, so it was settled before Braintree was settled. But
was it called Quincy then?
Yeah, it was. So it's a little bit weird. So Quincy as a city is named after Captain Quincy, who is like Abigail Adams's, like, I think, great-great-grandfather. So the dudes who dropped off the pilgrims, like, dropped them off, and they were kind of rowdy dudes, and the pilgrims were like, "Yo, man, can you kind of, like, not hang around us?" So they went further up the coast and settled in Quincy. The first place they settled was Marymount. It was John Morton and his Merry Men. And, like, you actually go still see Maypole Drive, like, where that was. And then you had, like, a trading center in Wollaston. Quincy, the reason Quincy became this like trading hub was there was a Hemarock, which was the seat of the local leadership for different indigenous tribes around the area. So that's why Quincy became like kind of like a trading post. And then eventually like Boston got settled. Boston was founded after Quincy, but the Boston Harbor, which kind of drove all that economic prosperity to the area, Quincy Bay is the biggest part of Boston Harbor in pure area, but obviously modern wharf systems are pushed more into Boston. So you had the Wollaston area, then you had, so first it was the Marymount area, Marymount Beach is like a really nice area, well, Quincy's nice, but like Marymount area, then you have Wollaston. That's the part of Quincy I grew up in, so that's,
So
no surprise, the guy is very biased, but John Adams is from where John Adams is from.
There's
a joke that we often have with Braintree, which is that like Braintree will be like, "We have the birth certificates," we're like, "Yeah, but we have the houses and the graves." It was actually, it's funny, John and Abigail Adams, their extended families, were actually some of the people that pushed for Quincy to become its own municipality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Quincy was founded in 1625, had its first settlement in 1640, chartered city in 1792, and then became a city in 1888. So obviously things progress kind of. Quincy was founded closer to the Last Crusade than it was to today, so there's a lot of history in between here.
Right. So I thought that Quincy was named after John Quincy Adams.
Yeah, other way
around. So I thought Braintree started out and then just renamed it after John Quincy was president. Okay. Yeah. So that's not quite.
Now, it's something I do want to say. So we haven't got to the sixth president. So you won't hear me say, probably won't say Quincy that much going forward. It is Quincy. It's not C. And I love getting.
I did say Quincy, right? Did I?
No, you said it correct. Right, yeah. Or? No, you said it.
Okay, good. All right.
And I get angry when people are like, you know, the other big one is Quincy, Illinois. And I've talked to, it's funny, we talk to about this sometimes. Sometimes at my job, I'll get calls from people who think they're calling Quincy, Illinois, which is kind of fun. And they call it Quincy. And I'm like, you're wrong. And they're like, no, that's how we pronounce it. I'm like, Quincy, Illinois? Quincy, Illinois, that's in Adams County? No. They're pronouncing it like the person's name. The name's Quincy. What are some good, I have so many random Quincy facts. There's been 13 ships named the USS Quincy, all of them named after the city of Quincy, Massachusetts. No other Quincy has claim to that because, as we're going to learn throughout this series, John Adams founded the Navy. So, Kyle.
Right.
Just, I know. He's your boy.
My boy. Yep. He is.
All right. So, I'm going to have to stop myself from just going on random Quincy rants throughout this entire episode.
Speaking of, I have a fun fact I can throw out there then. First submarine used in combat. It was actually during the Revolutionary War.
The USS Turtle.
I don't think we got a chance to talk about that. Yeah. It was not a very good success. I think they both died in operation.
It was like a suitcase. Like it was basically a suitcase sized bomb that tried to do it. It actually did explode. Yeah, I don't know how effective it was.
I think it just exploded in the wrong spot.
But Kyle, the real question is, did the washing machine and dryer catch on fire inside of it?
I don't think they are quite as advanced.
That is for the listeners who tune into some of the other shows, Kyle and I.
Right.
Yeah, so what's funny, so he didn't come from this like crazy prominent family, which is kind of interesting because a lot of the founding fathers came from fairly prominent families, but the first two founding fathers we talk about don't.
Right.
So we talked about Washington had very humble origins, so did John Adams. John Adams and George Washington probably isn't a surprise given that they were the first president-vice president combo. We're pretty close. They were close for two people from very, very different areas of the country.
Yeah.
So John Adams' father was John Adams Sr., and he was a shoemaker and a farmer. Pretty much the whole, almost everybody we talk about during this period of time are going to come from farming backgrounds. It's usually farming and then another artisan, craftsman trade.
I mean, you're on the frontier. You kind of have to be able to farm, right?
That's like problematic.
It's kind of an important. Yeah.
No, I'm really going to make it shoes. It's like, yeah, but do you have food?
You're right.
So
that's where peach cobbler came from.
Sorry. That was a great joke, actually, Kyle. That was pretty good. I'm a fan. Yeah, so he's his dad was also a deacon at the congregational church they went to. Now, real quick, if you go to the Church of Presidents today, it's a Unitarian church, but back a couple hundred years ago, it was a congregational church. What's funny is it...
Is that the one that's right across from your office, too?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's where the presidents are buried.
Yep.
What's funny, though, is that John Adams's mom was from a much, much more prominent family than his father. So Susanna Boylston, as in Boylston Street in Boston.
Okay.
Yeah. Big trading family. But her branch of the family was a medical family. They were some of the first real doctors we saw in this area of the country. Which is saying a lot, but being at the forefront of medicine in Boston is probably being the forefront of medicine in the world at this point.
Right.
Probably even to
which isn't saying much at that time, though, right? I mean, you're still talking about bloodletting and leeches.
What do they call it? The four, fluids and stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, God. What do they call those? They have a word for them, right?
It's gross. That's all I know.
Yeah. It's like the biles or something like that. Or,
it's like, yeah. I don't want to go to
No, let's not talk about that.
So you can go to John Adams, they have the John Adams birth house and stuff like that. It's actually It's on the court. It's near, ironically, it's near Dunkin' Donuts. So, again, he's the founding father. You can't go see where George Washington was born, but you can see where John Adams was born. That's still preserved. So, yeah, he comes from pretty humble beginnings because, as we all know, at this point in history, it's mostly you follow kind of your father's wealth, your father's status. So his father was a deacon and a shoemaker and a farmer. A lot of people, a lot of historians attribute John Adams had just a moral... He was a moral hardliner, if there's ever been one. And a lot of them attribute it to his both his parents, but particularly his father, because it was right is right. Doesn't matter. There's a million quotes from John Adams where he'll basically say, "I don't care if everybody in the world is against me. If I think it is right and I think it is moral, then that's it." He goes, he was he did not believe popular opinion dictated facts. Many reasons.
Interesting. It's kind of ballsy in a democratically elected society.
Yeah, right. It's a famous quote by Martin Luther King Jr. Democracy. So democracy can be perceived as tyranny by the majority.
What? Say it again.
I should probably fact check this, but Martin Luther King Jr. had a quote that was like, "Democracy is tyranny by the majority."
Yeah, something like that. There's another one I remember reading something about, like, democracy only works until everyone figures out that they can just vote for everything they want.
Yeah, it's called rent seeking. It's a horrible problem in economics.
Right.
But, yeah, so John Adams, you know, it was funny. So he was, we have a lot of knowledge of his early life, and he was, right from the beginning, brilliant kid. Just, like, as a child, just absolutely brilliant. This isn't a surprise he became what he became. I mean, listen, nobody should be expected to become president, but I think his parents knew from an early age that their child was incredibly gifted. So his parents were big on, obviously, being the son of a deacon. He grew up with very, I wouldn't say like puritanical views, because that's not what it was. They weren't Puritans, but grew up with a very active faith life, but hard work. You know, it's you do your job and you stick to your moral compass and success will come. Kind of funny to think of John Adams, like, he was kind of America's first statesman, if you want to call it that. Him and Ben Franklin. He was boys with Ben Franklin too. He got in a lot of trouble as a kid. Like, he was hard to contain. He was very independent. He didn't like authority. He would argue with his parents, he would argue with his teachers. But he would always do his work. He always do his work well. And he would always, you know, he would never forsake his moral fiber, which is kind of a cool, I know, I kind of like that.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the stories that stuck out to me, because I got to spend some time in Quincy and I checked out all of the stuff there with my wife, and the Boston Massacre. Like, he was, you talk about, like, right is right. Like, he actually defended the people accused of the massacre. And he got him off, too, didn't he?
Yeah. He got all but two of them.
Most of them. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's the Boston Massacre was kind of one of those, I want to describe this right. So, it was one of those crowning moments that really showed what the U.S., what the architects of the U.S. wanted. Mm-hmm. Were we going to be a nation, as Margaret Thatcher described it one time, Europe is founded on history, America on philosophy. Are we going to follow that? Are we going to be Luxonian democracy? Are we going to be a true republic where everybody, every man, and this is what Adams was big on, every man has a right to a defense.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, he wasn't a popular man when he did this. People saw him as
traitors. He was not.
His brother, not his brother, sorry, his cousin, Sam, where Sam Adams comes from.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a fiery dude. Sam Adams is an interesting cat. He was a smart man, but he wasn't this like brilliant political philosopher. He wasn't this amazing military technician.
He was like an inventor, wasn't he? But like not a very good inventor.
Oh, he dabbled.
His beer is the only thing I think that's still around that he did, right?
Yeah. So modern Sam Adams is named after this guy Jim Cook. Jim Cook. Renamed it after Sam Adams, but Sam Adams tinkered with everything. That's why I think people like I think that's why people like Sam Adams, to be honest with you. He was
right.
He was a dude who's just gone to everything. But he was a fiery, fiery man. They would hang out, like, he would go down to the Green Dragon pub, which you can still visit, Green Dragon Tavern, which is still up and running in Boston. And he would get fiery with people. And so Just so people know what the Boston Massacre is. So there was these group of laws that basically came about that were punitive. All right. So after you had the 7 Years War. All right. The French and Indian War cost the Brits a ton of money to defend us. They passed all these taxes. At this point, the U.S. was hardly taxed, and a lot of them targeted stuff like the Stamp Act and Townsend Act, all those stuff, and This was very punitive on the people of Boston. It also affected some of the trade. Now, one of the trade parts of being part of the British Empire was that your ports were limited for more or less to the British. You're probably all familiar with the Jones Act that currently is in the United States, have you heard of the Jones Act, Kyle?
I don't know if I have or not. Explain it to me.
So the Jones Act, it basically says that only U.S. ships, U.S.-built ships with U.S. crews can move material between two U.S. ports. It's why if you go on a cruise ship, you always, like, if you go on a cruise ship from Seattle to Alaska, you'll go, like, Seattle to Vancouver to, like, whatever place you stop in Alaska, like Anchorage or whatever it is. That's because you really didn't go to U.S. to U.S. port. Otherwise, it would have to be crewed by Americans. So that's a little bit, it's kind of the same. Like, at this time, the Port of Boston was one of the most powerful ports in the entire country. It was certainly, some people say it was the top port in the world. Some people say it's number two port in the world. But very powerful. But it was restricted.
It's up there.
Yeah, it was restricted to British trade. And so this group, they go up there and they're you have all these impositions, particularly the Townshend Acts, which imposed a large series of taxes on the colonies. And again, I don't want to make it sound like these taxes and these measures by the Brits were only affecting Boston. They weren't. We're just a much more cantankerous group of people. I think we're just...
I think everyone knows that.
So it's the middle of winter. I mean, freezing.
Let's get a little more context to that. Like, Boston is like one of the few places that was settled outside of like a company charter. Like, this was just dudes getting together and saying, this is how we're going to govern ourselves. So they're going to be much less likely to put up with a bunch of shit that like somebody who goes and works for the Virginia company is going to be willing to put up with. Because,
yeah,
just much different expectations.
Yeah. And we weren't connected to the rest of the country at all. Like, at this point, New York's not what New York is. New York's 400 miles southwest of us, which might as well be on a different planet.
Right, yeah.
You know, we established good trades with indigenous people. There's even trade going up into Canada. Fishing was a big one of our industries. There was a lot of lumber, like, when it first started, because England pretty much ran out of lumber at a point, and then we have live wood oak in this area of the country. We did have it in this area of the country. That's what old Ironsides made out of in terms of...
Yeah, that was... the cannonballs bouncing off her.
Yeah, because live wood oak is just an insane material to build a ship out of, to be honest with you. but it's sick. Like, you probably build, like, the deck of a ship and maybe the outer edge of it. Not like... Again, great Boston thing. No, build the whole ship. Whole ship's going to be... okay. But, we don't have that much.
Where's some of that ironwood? Yeah. Where'd you get some of that stuff?
Yeah, right, exactly. So they met... This mob formed outside of the customs house in Boston. So at the time... Just give you guys a little setting, all right? So... At this time, the Customs House in Boston is the tallest building in the United States by most estimates we have. So you can go see it today, by the way, guys. You can walk right up to it. There's a big, there's a giant, kind of looks like a big manhole, but commemorative plaque in the ground. You can see where the first person to die in the American Revolution, Crispus Attucks, who was a freed black man, was killed by the British. It's right across from Faneuil Hall. And it's right beside Boston City Hall, so you can go, like, go see, like, think of it, Faneuil Hall was right down there, because that was a center of trade. And it's right across from Faneuil Hall, which is the third most visited place, tourist attraction in the United States, which is still a baffling fact to me. Yeah, so Faneuil Hall is this, big trade area, and it's funny story, so Quincy, if you're ever looking for Quincy Market, which is, like, the trade area, has all these great restaurants, all these great boutique shops in there. So growing up, I worked, my family owned a gas station, and I'd be at the gas station, and like once a year you'd have somebody come in who's on like vacation, and they'd be like, hey, can I ask you something? I'd be like, yeah. They're like, this Quincy market doesn't seem like that cool of a thing. And I'm like, oh, right, yeah, some people don't like it, but yeah, no, I get it. And they go, no, it's just a convenience store. Somebody opened up a convenience store in Quincy and called it Quincy Market. So if you put it into Google,
oh my God,
it would show you Quincy Market Boston or Quincy Market Quincy, and everybody would go. So like, you get one guy who would be like, "Oh, Quincy Market Quincy," and just go into this like normal convenience store and be like, "Oh, this is like that's important to U.S. history."
Brilliant guy, by the way.
Dude, Mary Lou's in there now. It's awesome. Love it. I get coffee in there a couple times a week. Good guy. Yeah. So it's a big snowy night. The people go. You know, they're protesting outside, and there's Captain Thomas Preston. He's the person leading this small group, this detachment. It's about a platoon size element of
there's like 13 or so people, yeah. Right, roughly, or something like that.
Is that a platoon? Is platoon 16? Do I get that number wrong?
That a platoon was somewhere around like 12 to 15, but we didn't have platoons on a sub.
Be terrified. A platoon of submarines would be amazing. That'd be so much firepower.
I mean, sometimes they do carry around Marines.
That's scary. Imagine breaking into a submarine and just get attacked by Marines. You're like, oh, wow.
Oh, shit. It says it can be anywhere from 10 to 100, depending on the country and branch.
That doesn't help us at all.
No, it does not.
So there was about, there's about, maybe let's say 16, dozen and a half troops out there. And they were brought in to quell the mob. Now, this wasn't like the first unrest that took place in Boston related to these different acts. This has been going on for actually like a while at this point. And so these troops came out there. They were there to protect the custom house. Remember, this is 1770. This is still British taxes coming in there. And this didn't happen in a very quick time frame. Like a lot of times when this gets covered in history class, it gets glossed over very quickly and it loses nuance.
Yeah.
So this was a while. They were standing out there freezing cold, New England winter. I don't know if you guys have ever been here in the winter. Anybody's been to New England in winter. It's wet. It's like chills you to your bones. They're outside. Yeah. So Captain Thomas Preston was in charge of these troops. And he told them not to fire on the mob. So he told them not to fire on the mob. The protesters, rioters, whatever you want to call them, start throwing rocks at, start throwing snowballs, of all things, at these troops. And they move to rocks. And then apparently some of the stories say there was glass bottles thrown. I read one account that somebody said like a firecracker was thrown. I don't know if I fully trust. That's the only one source I've heard about that.
They have a lot of fireworks in 1770s?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of that. Like, I don't know if that's like one of those anachronisms that like somebody like threw. It's like watching a movie in the 60s and somebody pulls out a cell phone. It's like, well, that didn't happen.
Well, I mean, that was the first use of gunpowder was for fireworks in China. So, I mean, that's been around since like 900.
Yeah. Feels so, weird. I mean, I guess that's possible. Didn't make the jump to like using that the military setting.
Yeah, I'm just gonna throw a snowball at you and then maybe some snap crackers and
you hold this bottle rocket real quick.
Just I mean, how much did a glass bottle cost back then? I mean, that just seems like a waste.
Oh, yeah, right. Actually, good guy. I like that a lot. That's a good point, buddy.
Right,
so it goes on. Now some report, so well, actually we have John Adams to help us out here, because John Adams, this was adjudicated, he did defend these troops, but to this day in history we don't know who yelled fire. Tons of people report that the word fire was yelled. All right.
Right.
A lot of people think it was one of the protesters yelled it. But when the smoke cleared, there was five British citizens or British colonists or soon to be Americans dead.
Yeah.
So this, I mean, Boston ignites after this. Like, this was months and months of protests, leads up to five killed in this attack. The first one, Crispus Attucks, somebody who I'd argue is the first casualty of the American Revolution, the first American to die. So it's going crazy. Now, what, again, gets taught in history class is that John Adams stood up and banged his gavel and said, I will defend you in court. It's not what happened. They couldn't find...
He was asked to do it, wasn't he?
Yes, they couldn't find anybody. And now at this point, so John Adams, just quick background, when he was 16, he went to Harvard, eventually went to law school, didn't think he wanted to be a lawyer, moved to Worcester, which is like, I call Worcester mid-Mass. Worcester's actually like way closer to the east, but because I'm from Eastern Massachusetts, everything west of Boston is Western Massachusetts. So he was a school teacher in Worcester for a few years. He was just like, I don't really want to be an attorney. He came back, passed the bar, became an attorney. He was known for, he wasn't just known for taking on difficult cases. He was known for this like impunable reputation, impunable to immorality. This ability to where he would see cases objectively and factually, and he didn't allow his internal biases. He had opinions, but he wouldn't allow them to affect his view of reality. So they end up, they're getting ready to go to court for the Boston Massacre, and they're looking everywhere to try and find somebody. And they just can't. Nobody really wants to do it.
Nobody wants to defend the people who murdered a bunch of your friends.
Yeah. Now, what's funny is that Paul Revere and John Adams' cousin, Sam Adams, were riling everybody up. They're like, this is, we got to start the revolution. Now, the first shot, Lexington, the Battle of Lexington and Concord isn't happening for another 5 years. So the shooting happened March 5th, right? And yes, for all those people who are curious, we could still consider March winter in New England. And if you've ever been to Boston in March, you will consider that too. Kyle, you were up here in April, I believe, at one time.
Yeah, we just missed the slit your wrist to see some color season, I think, when we came up there. I know how it gets in February. It's not fun. It's just gray everywhere. Sorry, that was an old Dennis Leary joke.
It's an old Dennis Leary. Thank you for referencing Dennis Leary on that side. Yeah, so I mean, it's horrible weather out there, and so Sam Adams is like riling everybody up. He's like, "We gotta start the revolution. Let's boycott. Let's do all this." It goes on and on, and it wasn't until November of 1770. So what's that? 8 months later.
Yeah.
Which, if people say, "Oh, 8 months for a trial, that's fast," not when there's only tens of thousands of people living in your area.
Yeah. How many people are on that DACA? There's probably what 12 cases to hear the whole year.
So that's how long it took, and that was to start the trial, the trial of the men. Captain Preston, his trial started in October, but still, you're talking about a pretty long time.
Yeah.
So basically, they 50-50-ish kind of, Adams is open to doing it. They approach Adams if he'll represent them. And at this time, this is 1770, Adams is already known for being a patriot. He's already known for expressing opinions of the rejection of salutary neglect. So salutary neglect is what the British were doing, where they were ignoring us and collecting taxes from us. And there was always like, well, are you anti-salutary neglect, so you just want taxation representation, or are you a true patriot where you want to, you want to push for independence, you're a revolutionary. Adams is already known for being a patriot. His cousin, who is super close to Sam, is the guy running around, like, with Paul Revere, riling everybody up. But he takes on the case.
Was Thomas Preston like, fuck?
Actually, they were pretty, nobody knows how somebody feels in their heart. But it seems like they were quite happy it was Mr. Adams.
So he's already got a good reputation at that point. At least his reputation of morality supersedes his patriotism.
Yes, he was seen as kind of this moral compass guy who, even though he disagrees with you, is going to defend your right to be disagreed with. So the trial starts, and if we could split it, we'll split into two because they're kind of different. So the first one was the trial of Captain Thomas Preston, which, as I said earlier, started in October 1770. And that his whole thing was they were trying to figure out, did he yell for them to fire?
Right.
Nobody thought Captain Preston fired into the crowd. Nobody was like, did he shoot his musket at the guy with a sword? And basically, Adams successfully proved reasonable doubt and said nobody knows who yelled fire.
But this is the British court system at the time. Don't the British operate in a different, I guess, interpretation of things? Like, it's not necessarily guilty or innocent until proven guilty in the British system, right?
So this was kind of the first, like how you mentioned earlier, this is one of those first tests of independent, not the first test, but how this is an independent charter of faux constitution. Mm-hmm. And don't worry, we'll get to John Adams writing the Massachusetts Constitution. Longest still used constitution, also outlawed slavery, and is the basis of the Second Amendment. because John Adams is the greatest American. Not biased at all on that opinion. But no, so they had trials of their peers. Now, you got to understand, this was a huge deal in Boston. I don't think the Crown cared at all. Yeah. It was a huge deal to us. They were just like, oh, this is something that happened over across the ocean. We don't want to, you know, the colonists are already upset. They keep paying their taxes. Let them do their little song and dance in the court.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Adam successfully argues reasonable doubt. Nobody knows who yelled fire. Kind of famously, but I love this because we talk about modern day, we talk about witness testimony being very weak.
Yeah.
That was kind of John Adams' thing. He had a bunch of people basically claim when they heard fire, and based on where they were in the crowd, he was like, well, so nobody knows who yelled it.
Right.
You can't blame this guy.
Right. Yeah.
Much more controversial. And there was some anger at Preston because he, by the Fathers of the Revolution, let's call them that, Sons of Liberty, which is the organization that Paul Revere and Sam Adams were part of. But I don't know if this was an excuse they were using to try, you know, fan the flames of revolution. But there wasn't this, like, concentrated hatred on Preston. They were concentrating on Preston, but it was more because he was the senior officer, right? Like,
Yeah.
But it wasn't like...
His men did something and he wasn't in control. That's...
Right.
On him.
Right. Yeah. Bingo. The trial of the soldiers was really, really different because that was viewed, especially in the aftermath of Adams' successful defense of Preston, as like, well, these are the guys who killed those five Bostonians. And it was a messy trial. It was a real messy trial.
Mm-hmm.
So part of there was a couple different points of argument made here. One of them was the evidence at hand. All right. Nobody was doubting that five people got shot, or several people got shot, but that five people died. And Adams admitted that. But what Adams emphasized is that what responsibility, and this is the most Adams thing in the world, and this is why I love him, responsibility. Who's responsible for this happening? And he emphasized that it was a violent crowd that was threatening the troops. They were throwing snowballs, ice, glass. And they were yelling.
Fireworks.
Yeah, maybe fireworks. I can't wait to die. You get to learn the mysteries of the universe. God's like, what would you like?
Right.
Were there fireworks back then? He's like, really? That's what you want to know?
That's the only thing.
Only thing. And that the crowd was impeding the ability of the troops to even form a safe perimeter. And he said, you know, if you're threatening somebody and threatening somebody and threatening somebody, and then we don't even know who yelled fire. And it was kind of brilliant that they argued the Preston case before the rest of the soldiers.
Yeah.
You have the right to self-defense. And Adams hit my favorite quote he ever had. And I'm going to read it because that's how much I love it. And I think this is a quote that applies to even today. He said, "Facts are a stubborn thing. And whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence." Oh, how do you not love like a guy who thinks like that?
Right.
He has another great quote that's like, you know, you're entitled to your opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. Just awesome. So at the end of it, there were eight of the soldiers were tried. Six were acquitted. Two were found guilty of manslaughter.
I think they were just kind of sent back home too, right? I don't think anything really too bad happened to them, right?
No, so they were supposed to be hung.
Right.
Like, and it's funny. So this got kind of, this became kind of a weird part of, I'll talk about the first six real quick, the ones who were acquitted. So like, it was kind of awkward because like immediately after those six were like acquitted, they were like, what do we do with these dudes? So... we don't
send them home. Yeah. Get them out of here.
They're basically like, dude, these guys get tired and feathered.
Yeah.
The other two, so they were, you know, convicted, and they got sentenced. I forget what their exact sentence was at the time because
manslaughter.
Yeah. I'm not gonna mess with you. This is gonna sound real goofy, but the reason they weren't like hung or like anything bad happened is they got something called the benefit of the clergy.
I see. I was just looking at that. Yeah. Which
basically means they claim to be clergymen. Everybody was like, oh, okay. And just let them leave.
I mean, you got to think, too. It's been a year almost at this point, too.
Yeah.
Right?
I just...
Are you really still that angry?
Yeah, but I'm also curious, but they were like, like, I don't know, maybe, like, the Brits do, like, you know, the U.S. always deserves a right to, like, invade The Hague in case, like, there's, like, a criminal trial going on. The U.S. military is like, oh, we can just go extract our guy from there. We're not going to, like, follow this convention. We don't need that.
Right, right.
But I do like that they're like, no, they're clergymen. It's like, no, there's... What?
Can you still do that? Does that still work?
It's still a thing.
I'm going to write that down.
Can't wait till you go rob a bank and you're like, no, I have the privilege of the clergy.
I am a church of Judaism. Judaism. Oh, also, sorry, one more thing that I just see here, looking at the names of the soldiers who were in this trial. One of them's name is Kilroy. Is it just a happy coincidence?
I really hope so.
Or did Kilroy is there too?
No, I do know that one is... that comes from a ship welder in the...
Yeah.
I do know that one.
We got actually a sticker. I found one on my refrigerator after we got home. I think Laura went and snuck one when I wasn't looking.
Dude, those things are so cool. So fun fact, if you're ever visiting Quincy and you go to Marina Bay, we're one of the few places in the world that has the lone sailor statue. Kyle, you've probably seen it before. It's the sailor, and he has a giant bag. It's a huge statue. It's like 9 feet tall. There's one in Guam. There's one in Annapolis. And we had a destroyer plant down at Marina Bay at the time. And we have all these things with different admirals from Quincy. One of them is Fritz, is it Adams?
Oh, it's the sea bag. Okay. Yeah, I got one of those bags. Yeah.
What did I call it? I called it like luggage. Just
it is a giant bag.
That's insulting. Yeah, but we have this huge wall that looks like a destroyer. And if you walk behind it, you can actually see we had somebody spray paint Kilroy was here.
That's awesome. I think we're almost through this trial, right?
Yeah, so the aftermath. So the two dudes who get convicted, they get branded on their thumbs. That was their punishment.
Mm-hmm. That's weird punishment. That's okay.
Bizarre punishment. That's one of those things where I just don't think that was ever mentioned in history class.
No. All right. But how much did the acquittal of most of these guys, like, did that fan more of the flames for revolution? Did that give Sam Adams and Revere more ammunition to go rile up the rest of his countrymen? Like, if these people had been hung, would we still have gone the same course or same path that we went down with the revolution?
I'm going to offer a controversial opinion here. I think the restraint that was showed through Adams' actions actually encouraged more revolution, because it showed that this would be orderly, that this would be done not like previous revolutions, bloody affairs where tyrants rise and tyrants fall, that we're going to do this by law and order, that we're not going to take the simple, easy way, just hang a bunch of, you know, soldiers that were doing their job protecting the customs house. No, we're going to argue this in court. We're going to show we're better than the Brits, that we occupy a higher point of philosophy. I think Sam Adams being John Adams' cousin was huge, because it's like, you're not going to go, you know, pick a fight with your cousin.
Right.
I think John Adams' history at this point, I mean, John Adams was only, he was only 35 when this happened. Mm-hmm. That's kind of crazy. The fact he was a well-known patriot, that he was adamant, the fact that he did not argue the Brits have the right to do it, or these are just soldiers. But the fact that he argued on the basis of facts, that he said, it doesn't matter what your opinion is, it only matters what the facts are. It showed that this was going to be a philosophical revolution, and that we're capable of governing ourselves, and our ideas of governing are better. Think of it. Your only options were chaos or a monarchy. That was like your two options in the Western world at the time. Right. And this dude's like, what if it was us? What if it's just fact-based democratic republic? I think that kind of fanned the flames that we can do this.
Yeah, yeah. There's one other thing that you mentioned that I think I want to just touch on before we wrap up this part one here. The peaceful transfer of power you mentioned. That probably, I mean, you mentioned the friendship between Adams and Washington, Adams being his, you know, vice president. The transition of power between Washington to Adams was probably not a thing. Nobody was concerned about that. But as we start to learn more about the campaign that he ran against Thomas Jefferson, I think we see a much different story. And so the actual completion of the transfer of power after such a contentious election cycle, I think that was the first time that was ever really put to the test.
Yeah, it was.
And if it had been anybody else, would we have had the same outcome?
I mean, it is fascinating because, right, because John, for the first, it's not just that it's a peaceful transfer of power. You're 100% right about that, Kyle. But it's even more beautiful than that because John Adams had to certify his own electoral defeat.
Oh.
Think of that. Because that's how, wow. Yeah, right, the vice president, he was the vice president at the time, but he was the president. So don't forget, it wasn't until 1803 that you ran as a mm-hmm. ticket, right? You kind of 1800, like Jefferson and Burr kind of ran together, and then Adams and Pinckney, I think that's how you pronounce his name, they kind of ran together and they lost. But it wasn't like the traditional like vice president role that you think of today, where like that dude was never going to be president. Like he was in office, it was his mm-hmm. vice president that he effectively tells what to do at this point, certifying that election. So that's even crazier. It's not like you just shut the door and leave. Like, he could have obstructed this. He was the president
right.
at the time.
Right.
And he didn't. And if the Boston Massacre is kind of that first sign that, no, we're going to do this responsibly, then you'll get all that contention of the election of 1800, which, again, at the time, him and Jefferson hated each other. But you're right. They always, I mean, I think they always loved each other. Like, I'm just going to be honest with you. I think they hated each other.
Right.
But I think they secretly loved each other.
Still respected each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is weird because I feel like, as we'll talk more in this series, that John Adams, if you look at his moral code, and you look at Jefferson's moral code, they didn't line up at all.
No.
Not at all. But yeah, it was, would have happened without Adams? I don't know, but we're damn lucky as a nation that it was Adams sitting in that seat the first time the power had to be switched over to a different party.
Yeah, amen to that. All right. Anything else you want to cover, life, background, character, before we close this one up?
I mean, yes, but we don't have enough time. You know, several days for me to rant. So just, you know, transitioning after his, after the Boston Massacre, it's 1770, so 1770 to the kickoff of the American Revolution, about 3.5 years later, 4.5 years later, 1775, from the end of the trial to then. What was Adams doing that time frame? He was being Adams. He was a delegate to the Massachusetts legislature. He was elected to the Continental Congress. He was advocating for all these principles of revolution. But he was that guy who defended the British. But he didn't mm-hmm. defend them for being British. He didn't defend them because they were British and they have the right to be colonizers. He was defending them because rule of law is rule of law. And he carried that. So for the next 5 years, as we transition towards the the first shots being fired at Lexington Concord, and then another year and a half later, the Declaration of Independence, which he helped co-author with Jefferson. He became boys with Washington. I mean, Washington loved each other. He was the one who nominated Washington to lead the Continental Congress because he was just like, we need this, this general with British military experience who's from Virginia, kind of like the
6 foot 20 and
yes. walk around with
horse teeth.
right. So this carried on through his legacy. He married the greatest first lady of all time, Abigail Adams. He had a couple kids during this, one of them being John Quincy Adams. I'm going to cover this since it's the end of the episode, and it's not a great part about John Adams' life. I mean, I want to hopefully bury this. No, I'm joking. We're never going to bury anything on the show, but
no.
In terms of being a supportive dad, maybe not. Maybe not the most supportive dad in the world. But, I mean, let me say this. Supportive, yes, he helped his kids achieve, he set his kids up to achieve great things, but not like the encouraging father. So, John Quincy Adams was brilliant. He's arguably the smartest president ever to live. That's not like Eric's opinion. You can like read historians and think he's the smartest president ever to live. The guy was the only his son is arguably the greatest public servant to ever live. He was a senator. He was a president. And he was unanimously nominated to the Supreme Court. He ended up serving the House of Reps. He broke the gag rule, inspired Abraham Lincoln's generation to free the slaves. Like, he raised a son who the worst thing he ever did was become president. Like, the guy is, I mean, his son spoke 7 languages and was a diplomat at 13 to Russia. Like, his just bonkers, right? His other son had the opposite reaction to too much pressure and drank himself to death.
Aww.
So, a little bit of balance there. Abigail Adams once famously wrote a letter to John Quincy Adams, her son, saying it's better for you to have essentially drowned going over to Europe than not become president. And this is when he was like 12, 14 years old. Yeah.
All right, so.
But I do want to say one thing. Their son became president. Like, it worked. Like, for that one specific case, it worked. Not recommended, but it worked.
Right. It worked for one of them.
Yeah.
The other one did not become president.
Yeah, so he, and, you know, it's, I don't want to say joking aside, but in a more serious tone, like, he held his kids to insanely high standards. And that can be problematic. And, like, hey, like, we talk about, it's not problematic as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson owning slaves. Those are two, certainly. Two different things.
Yeah, on the sliding scale of
yeah.
black marks.
Yeah, yeah, right. So, but like we said, we're never going to couch presidents. We're never going to make them sound like they're demigods, even if I think John Adams is the most important founding father, and I'm literally wearing a shirt with the word Quincy on it right now, and I drive by his house every day to go to work, and I drive by Abigail Adams' house where she was born.
Recording this right outside his house.
Yes, exactly. I still think, you know, Kyle and I talked about this when we started the podcast. We have to be honest with what these presidents were, right? They were humans. They were flawed. Yep. Were his flaws as bad as the rest of them? Probably not, if I'm going to be honest. But
the worst thing I think I could say about him is just his portrait is hilarious.
So bad. It's so bad. You can tell that he was not well liked.
Do you think that portraitist got paid on that one? I'd get Ray back for that.
So I guess the one last note before we jump off. John, we talked about kind of the vice president certifying the election. John Adams is a big reason why the modern vice president is so useless, because he was notorious for making fun of senators. So they're supposed to be effectively the president, or not effectively, they are the president of the Senate. And yeah. So John Adams would go there and just make fun of stupid arguments he would hear, and he would be very personal and attack people for their stupidity. Like,
why do I love that?
And so they voted in first term of Washington, they voted that the vice president's not allowed to talk in the Senate.
In Congress.
Yeah.
Or in the Senate.
Yeah. And that's why there's a president pro tempore of the Senate who's like calls everything to order and stuff like that. And that's still today, 200 to 240 years later. We have powerless vice presidents who can't vote on anything besides when there's a tiebreaker, all because John Adams would just make fun of people for stupid arguments.
Well, I don't know if that's quite the bombshell to end this thing on, but it does seem like a good place to put a pin in it for part one here. Well, please join us next week. We'll start picking apart the policies that define Adams' presidency, and I think we're probably going to spend a lot of time on that Aliens and Seditions Act. Seeing how that's become quite topical lately. In the meantime, we do want to hear from you. What do you make of Adams's character? Do you think he deserves all the credit, or does Abigail deserve some of that? Email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com, or you can visit the website, buckstartsherepodcast.com, to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week.